마삼부다사남모타사바그와토아라하토삼마삼부다사남모타사바그와토아라하토삼마삼부다사부탄다만산탄나마사미Tonight I'd like to start with a Jataka tale. And the Jataka tales are stories of the Buddha's life before he became fully enlightened. They're stories about the work that he had to do in order to develop the qualities of heart that would enable him to become fully enlightened, and not only fully enlightened, but also be able to teach others. And so this is a Jataka story about wisdom. And sometimes in the Jataka stories, the Buddha is the main player, and sometimes he's a human being, sometimes he's an animal. In this one, he's a sort of marginal player. But it's set in Benares, a city in India, long, long time ago. And at that time, it was the New Year season, and everyone was getting ready for 3 days of celebration. And the gardener who was in charge of the king's pleasure garden also wanted to go and enjoy himself with his family for the New Year season. But he needed someone to do the work for him in the garden while he was away. Especially he needed someone to water the plants for him. And it just so happened that there was a band of monkeys that came to the pleasure garden every day to feed. And so the gardener thought that he would ask the monkeys if they would water the plants for him. And so he approached the king of the monkeys and asked him if he would kindly do the job of watering especially the young plants for the 3 days. And if they did that, then they could eat as much of the fruit and the nuts of the trees that they wanted to. And so the king of the monkeys agreed that he would get his band to do the watering. And so the gardener gave them the watering cans and went off to enjoy the 3 days of celebration. Now the king of the monkeys was in charge, and his followers didn't have to think much because they just followed what the king instructed them to do. And so the king said to his band of monkeys, I want you to divide up into teams, and I want you to work together. And because it's very important that we don't waste water when we do this work, I want one of you to dig up the tree that you're watering and see how long its roots are. And then the other one will give as much water as that tree needs. Some of the trees will only have short roots, and so we don't want to waste water putting too much water on them. But some of them will have long roots, and so they'll need more water. And so I want you to put enough water on for the long roots also to be fed. And so the monkeys didn't think much about it, and so they went about digging up all the trees, pulling them all out to see which had the short roots and which had the long roots and how much water they should put on them, because it was very important not to waste water. And it just so happened that while the monkeys were doing this, the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, who was at that time born as a wise person in Benares, walked past the pleasure garden, and he saw what the monkeys were doing. And he said to them, hey, that's not the right way to go about your work. You'll kill those plants if you do that. You shouldn't pull them out. But the monkeys were so sure that what they were doing was correct that they didn't listen to him, and that they would only follow the instructions of their king. And so the Bodhisattva was unable to convince them, and he thought to himself, if the king is the wisest one amongst this group, then all the rest of them must be really dull. And so he was unable to change their mind, and he went off. And of course, when the gardener came back after 3 days, yes, his plants were all watered, but they were all dead because they'd been pulled out of their holes. But this story is about wisdom gone wrong, and that's the theme of my talk tonight, because very often these days we hear about the Buddha's teachings given in a very popular style. Very often parts of the Buddha's teaching have become almost ordinary words in today's language. So we hear words like karma, we hear about merit, we hear about things to do with how we should live our life. And there is a very strong tendency for Buddhism to get mixed up with popular culture and for Buddhist teaching to be misunderstood or not to be really understood clearly, just in the way that the monkeys knew that it was important not to waste water, but they didn't have the wisdom to know that you don't pull out the trees to look to see how much water you should put on. So if we get a little bit of the Buddha's teaching mixed up with everyday philosophy or the wisdom of the latest gurus in the magazines or on the radios or whatever, then we're likely to get not the full story, and sometimes we can go wrong. It's about one of these particular phrases that I'd like to talk tonight, and that is a phrase from the 1970s, which is still popular today, and that is the phrase about going with the flow. And this is something which we've probably all heard, although I was surprised today, and I'm grateful that I asked the people who brought Dana today, Shirley and Florence, if they had heard this phrase, and they said no, they hadn't. So it's a very dating phrase for me to be talking about, because it shows where I come from, and that's the 1970s. In the 1970s, this was a very popular way of trying to make change and coming to terms with the changes that were happening in society. And going with the flow was a way to encourage us to be more relaxed about change, to be more accepting, to try and be in harmony with the way things were going, and not to resist. And not to resist our own emotions even. We were very used to suppressing our emotions and to being on guard against our ideas if they were very different from other people's. And so now we were encouraged, no, let the emotions go, let them flow, go with the flow. And so this saying from the 1970s is still current today, but we hear it often confused with the Buddha's teachings. And this is easy to understand, because in Buddhism we're especially looking at the inner work that needs to happen, and there's not so much the primary focus on outer conditions. So this teaching of not resisting what you can't change, just not being too concerned, just bending with things, that seems to fit in with the Buddha's teaching. And the other aspect of the Buddha's teaching, which seems to fit in very well with this going with the flow idea, is the idea of acceptance and equanimity in Buddhism. Very often there's this perception that Buddhists are really easy to get along with. They never really make any problems. They don't really object to things. They're, you know, quite a pushover, basically. And so this is another reason why this idea of going with the flow has been taken up sometimes as a misrepresentation of the Buddha's teaching. So tonight I'd like to talk about the Buddha's teaching on going with the flow, because sometimes in Buddhism we are encouraged to go with the flow, but at other times we're encouraged to go against the flow. And one of the memories I have of the use of this sort of term in the 1970s was a university friend of mine, and he was very much for going with the flow. And his interpretation of this was, of course, to go with what I like in the flow. And so he had a very good way of approaching his going to university every day. When he got out of bed, even if it wasn't whatever time he woke up basically, if he went out, had his breakfast and then went out and waited for the bus to go to uni, if a bus came along that was on its way to uni, then he'd get on it. But if a bus didn't come along, if it came along and was going somewhere else, he would take that as an indication that the flow that day was not towards uni, was back home. And so this is the sort of way that we've been able to use this kind of teaching to say that when we have a desire, we shouldn't resist it, we should just go with it. And although it sounds laughable, there are many people these days who still have that understanding that desires should be satisfied and then we'll find some happiness. And there are even teachers who advocate that their students should try to satisfy their desires without trying to repress what comes up as a wish in their mind. And so it's important for us who are wanting to be guided by the Buddha's teaching to really understand the Buddha's teaching on this aspect. And the Buddha did very often use the simile of craving being like a river that was flowing along. But the way that the Buddha described craving was that this river was not only flowing along, it was pushing us along. And we were actually so pushed along by this river of craving that it made it very difficult for us to know what is for our own good and what is for the good of others, what is for our own harm and what is for the harm of others. So it makes it very difficult for us when we're just being pushed along by craving to really make reasonable decisions and sensible choices. And if you imagine yourself, as the Buddha described, being swept along by a river, you don't have any control and you're grabbing at the banks to try and stop yourself from being swept away. So you're going from one side of the river to the other, trying to get onto something, trying to get a foothold somewhere. But it's all out of your control. And this is the way the Buddha described craving. And he said that we should go against the flow, go against the stream of craving. Not that we should go with the flow. Because he said that craving is what binds us to the wheel of birth and death. Craving and ignorance. Craving, which brings us back time and time again to try to get it right this time, to try to be fulfilled, to find the ultimate experience that is going to be satisfying. This bhava tanha, the craving to be, is what brings us back to each rebirth. And supporting that is karma tanha, karma meaning sensuality, the desire to have sensual pleasures, to have things that delight us, things that we enjoy. This is the glue, this delight, which sticks us in samsara. And if we can't get things the way we want them to be, then vibhava tanha, the other aspect of tanha, makes us work very hard to try to get away from or to eliminate those things which we don't like. So these three kinds of craving, tanha means craving, bring us back over and over again to rebirth, supported by ignorance. Ignorance and craving go hand in hand. And the ignorance is to not understand that craving can never, never be satisfied. There is no coming to the end of craving. And this is the basic misunderstanding that people have who think if they just stick at it long enough, they will finally get it right and things will be so good that they will be satisfied. The Buddha said, even if it rained gold coins three times a day, we still wouldn't be satisfied with what we can get. And the other simile that he gave is, it's like putting sticks on the fire. The fire is our desire to be. And the sticks that we put on it is the intentional action that we do to try to maintain ourselves, to keep us going, and also to have things the way we want. As long as we keep putting sticks on the fire will keep going. And if you imagine that this fire is fueled by craving and ignorance, you can see that the fire will never go out as long as we keep feeding it. That is, keep grasping, keep seeking after those things which we think are going to give us the satisfaction or happiness that we seek. What we have to do is to stop feeding the fire, stop putting the sticks on. And so this is directly contrary to the idea that we'll finally reach a point where we can be satisfied. It's important for us to understand the nature of desire. Desire always implies that something is missing in the present moment. Something's not quite right, and so we have to reach for something else to add to the present moment experience to make it complete. And during the meditation, you might have recalled or heard that I said, if the mind has wandered away from the present moment, what's it looking for? This is a question we very rarely ask ourselves. We just take for granted that wherever it's wandered to is what we need, that it's right, because that's the desire, the thought that's coming to the mind. So now we might start to ask ourselves, instead of where is it wandered to, what's missing right now that's made it wander away? Now, as I said, the Buddha's teaching is that we can never come to the end of desire just by feeding desire. And if you think about it, as we move to something which we think is going to fulfill us, is going to complete this moment of our experience, as we move towards that, there's the expectation, there is this sense of excitement, I'm going to get it. And that's where there's a sense of pleasure. When we get whatever it is that we've moved towards, very soon afterwards, the feeling of discontent returns. That pleasure which we've been seeking, which we think is going to fulfill us, is very short-lived. Now, if you just think of an everyday experience, you finally finish the dishes, time to sit down and watch a bit of television. So, you get ready. Now, the television's on, but the lights aren't right. Should we have them on or off to have the right effect? Should we have the air conditioner on or should we have it off? Now, I've just gotten the cushions correct, that's just right, but I might as well have something to eat while I sit here and watch the television. Oh, now if I'm going up to get something to eat, I might as well have a drink as well. And then all finally settled and we're watching the television and ads come on, right in the middle of the program. Finally we've settled and we think this is really it, just the program I like, my favourite program, watch it, that's great. What happens? It finishes. Ah, it's over. The whole thing starts once again. Where am I going to go to get rid of this feeling of discontent that has arisen since this thing has finished? The discontent is there again, and so we have to go once more to try to do something, to feed it, to rest it, to entertain it, to grasp at something to try to get rid of this feeling of discontent. It's an ongoing process. We never get to the end. And the Buddha's teaching is not to try to get to the end by feeding it, but to try to get to the end by being able to bear with the feeling of discontent. To be able to bear with the fact that there is no end to craving, and that there is no ultimate experience that we can have through the five senses. The only ultimate experience is nirvana. But one of the interesting things which we can observe as we try to practice in meditation is that when desire is present, thinking arises. Because thinking is the servant of desire. When we think about what we're going to get and how we're going to get it. We plan and we scheme. This is papancha, the Pali word, according to the Buddha's teaching. So when desire is there, thinking arises. And that thinking tries to serve desire. When desire is absent, then thinking can also subside. And then we find peace in our meditation. Thinking and desire feed off each other. So if we want to ever experience the peace beyond the thinking mind, then we have to work at letting go of desire. Until we experience the peace beyond the thinking mind, then we're always going to be caught on the treadmill of trying to satisfy our desires, because that's all we'll ever know that life can offer to us. It's only once we get beyond that and experience the peace beyond the five senses that we can know that there's more to life, and that when desire arises, that it's not the ultimate. We don't have to follow it thinking, well, this is all there is in life. So it's very important for us to start to really understand how desire comes into being. But first of all, I'd like to address a couple of other points that I made at the beginning of the talk, and then I'll lead into understanding desire more at a closer level. One of the other reasons why Buddhism gets caught up with popular teachings about going with the flow and accepting things is this confusion about what equanimity means in the Buddha's teaching. Very often people have the idea that equanimity means not doing anything, letting things just roll over it, if you like. And this is a misunderstanding of equanimity in Buddhism. Equanimity means being able to maintain an evenness of mind, not losing one's balance in the good things and the bad things of life, so that one is able to make the right choice about what is the most skillful and appropriate response to the situation that we're facing. It may be that that response is to do nothing, but it may be that the appropriate skillful response is to do something that's very active. And so this is a very important distinction, if you like, from the idea of Buddhism is about sitting back and not taking any action at all. But if we look at the Buddha's teaching on equanimity, we can see that equanimity is used or refers to a number of different kinds of equanimity. And so I'd like to just outline these to you briefly. The first kind of equanimity is the equanimity that we hear about in relationship to the four Brahma Viharas. The four Brahma Viharas are loving kindness, compassion, joy in the happiness of others, and equanimity. And this kind of equanimity refers to our emotional relationship to people around us. This kind of equanimity is built on a feeling of loving kindness, of universal goodwill towards all other people and all other beings. It's built on a feeling of compassion, a feeling of sincere wish for the well-being of others, that they may be free of suffering. And it's built on the joy that we feel in the success and happiness of others. And once we start to look out from our own narrow focus, beyond the circle of people who are our near and dear ones and whose happiness is most important to us and whose safety is most concern to us, to a wider field of people, then we start to develop a more realistic picture of what life is like. Because when we keep our focus narrowly on just the people of our family, or the people who are our friends, the people we like, then we have, if you like, all our eggs in a small basket. If something happens to those people, then we're very upset. If something good happens, then we get very happy. But we're very vulnerable in that situation because we're focusing our attention on a very narrow field. When we start to spread our attention more widely and take joy in the success of others and care about what happens to a wider range of people, then, if you like, we start to spread our risks around. We don't have them just in a very narrow sort of area. And so when something unfortunate happens to someone that we care about, we don't get swept away by the thought, why did this have to happen to me? I don't deserve this. They don't deserve this. Because we have practiced being concerned and taking an interest in a whole range of people outside our narrow circle of friends and family. And from that, we've understood that these things, these bad things, these unhappy things, happen to everyone. And it hurts everyone, just like it hurts me, just like it hurts the person that I'm concerned about, that I'm close to. And when good things happen, well, we never think, why did this have to happen to me? Gee, I don't deserve this. We take it as a matter of course. But when we expand our field, we also see that good things happen to people, and we can be happy, we can rejoice, we can be able to feed off, if you like, their happiness free of charge, because we're just happy in their happiness. And so this makes us much less vulnerable to the ups and downs of life, because we see that this is just part of the flow of life. So in this is a way in which we do go with the flow. We see that this is what happens. The next way in which equanimity is used is in terms of the paramis, the qualities of heart which the enlightened being had to develop in order to become fully enlightened. So he had to develop wisdom, but he also had to develop equanimity. And this is the kind of equanimity that understands and accepts the eight worldly winds. The eight worldly winds refer to the normal ups and downs of life that occur to everyone. Praise and blame, fame and ill fame, happiness and unhappiness. What's the next one? Praise and blame, loss and gain, that's it. Praise and blame, loss and gain, fame and ill fame, happiness and unhappiness. Now, what we can understand as we start to contemplate these eight worldly winds is that they blow on everyone. Doesn't matter who they are, the rich and the famous, the poor, the old, the foolish, the wise, the Buddhists, the non-Buddhists, the Australians, the everyone else. They're just universal aspects of our experience of being human beings. And if we observe how they arrive in our lives and in the lives of others, we understand that we can't have just one part of them without also having its opposite. If we have a lot of happiness, then when that happiness passes away, there's going to be unhappiness of a sort, because we've been up and now it's gone, so we're down. Nothing terrible has to even happen, but we see that the happiness has given way to unhappiness. And as we contemplate this in our own lives and in the lives of others, and we see it all around us in the newspapers and from the people we know, we start to become more accepting of the ups and downs, the highs and lows of life, without getting bowled over by them when they arise. And this is equanimity, being able to maintain our balance. Our balance, it's important to maintain even in the good times. Very often we get swept away with the good things that happen to us, and we imagine that they're going to last forever. And so we lose it. We lose our balance in those times just as much as in the difficulties. So once we start to familiarize ourselves with these ups and downs and these changes, we understand that these are a part of life. And so when they come into our experience, we're able to receive them with this balance of mind. Of course, we may get bowled over for a short while, but we don't allow ourselves to remain in that kind of state. Now, these kinds of equanimity arise through being able to contemplate experience on a fairly gross level. But if we're able to do this, then it does certainly help us to make good use of the experiences of life to develop wisdom. A very good example of this kind of equanimity and acceptance that leads to wisdom is the example of someone whose daughter died of a drug overdose, of an overdose of ecstasy. And this was in Sydney when I was there, just maybe 2 years ago. And this young girl had overdosed and had been taken to hospital, but she was unable to be revived. And she came from what you would say, quote, a good family, loving family, middle class family, none of the normal sort of difficulties of life that would cause someone to take an overdose of drugs. So it was purely accidental. Now, from having the experience of losing her daughter, her family, of course, were very overwhelmed with grief and shock and shame that this had happened. Her parents were devastated that their daughter from a quote, good family, should die in this way. And then to discover that this wasn't the first time that she'd taken the drug. She'd been taking it quite regularly as a way of enjoying herself with her friends. And she was only 14. So the family were very upset. But the mother took a very good attitude to this, in that she understood that this death was the result of a whole lot of causes and conditions that had supported the behaviour that the girl was engaging in and had resulted in this final death. Part of the causes and conditions were the parents' blindness to what was going on with their daughter and their desire to have things nice and easy, nice and pleasant, and so not to to challenge or to make things difficult in the family, and to be too concerned with their own life, too busy with what they were doing to really pay attention to what was happening with their child. And so this mother went from grieving about the loss of her own daughter to seeing what she could do to try to untangle the tangle that had led to her daughter's death. And also based on the understanding that what had happened in their family and to her daughter was likely to happen in other families and was likely to leave other families devastated by the loss of one of their dear ones. And so she expanded her compassion. She expanded her concern for lot beyond just the narrow circle of the people that she cared about. She wanted to help other families and other children who might get into the same problems. She didn't just retire with the idea of, why did this happen to me? This is such a terrible thing. As very often we can do, we think we're the only person in the world who's ever suffered a loss. We're the only person in the world who's ever had to deal with this kind of difficulty. But she didn't stay in that sort of mind space. She came out and she saw the universality of the situation that she was confronting in this day and age. And so she made it her business from then on to, together with the her daughter's sister, so another younger daughter who was 16 at the time, to go out and try to educate people about the difficulties that were facing young people and also the enticements, the seduction of the fact that these drugs were available, that they were accessible for young ones, and that there were many opportunities in the way that young people were spending their leisure time for them to be taking these drugs and not to be known by the family. So this mother was a very good example of someone who was bowled over to start with by what had happened to her, but because she was able to move beyond the narrow circle of her family and her own concerns to see the universality of the suffering that she was undergoing and to really fire her to try to prevent suffering in others, she was able to go and do something constructively about helping others. Not just helping and educating the children, but helping and educating families to be more aware, not to turn a blind eye, to be more sensitive to what was going on with their children. And so for me, this is a very good example of the idea of equanimity, that it's not a matter of just accepting that this has happened, what to do about it, but seeing that there is something positive that one can do as a reaction to a situation. So the Buddhist idea of equanimity, meaning acceptance and not doing anything, is certainly a wrong understanding. Now the next aspect of equanimity is the wisdom aspect, which is really the way that we can confront desire directly. Until we understand how desire arises in the mind, what feeds it, what allows it to continue, and how we work to let it go, we will never be able to come to the end of desire. So we need to be able to understand the way that the mind works in relationship to desire. The mind is made up of different aspects. And one of the aspects of the mind which we can cultivate is the ability to observe thoughts as they arise. Until we start to meditate, we are under the impression that thinking is the only thing that goes on in the mind. But when we practice just for a little while, we glimpse a moment of spaciousness in the mind, the space between thoughts. And as we continue to practice, we practice to make those spaces between the thoughts even longer and to occur more often. So we start to get a little bit of space in the mind. And that space in the mind allows us to observe the flow of the mind. We get to the point where we can sense almost a thought about to arise before it actually arises. And then we observe it as it arises. And the simile that's very useful to as a way of describing this is that we become like a bystander who's watching a parade go by. Different floats go by in front of us. And in the past, when we didn't have any spaciousness in the mind, the floats, like our thoughts, would entice us and we'd jump right on. Before we knew it, we'd be in the parade and on the float and going down the road. And once we become more skilled in our meditation and we have more spaciousness in the mind, we're like the bystander who can watch the floats as they go by without having to jump on them and get in the parade. So we know what kind of thought is arising in the mind. We can observe it as it plays itself out and it passes away. Now the thought that gives rise to action, which propels us to reach out for something which we think is going to fulfill our desire, remove the feeling of discontent that we're experiencing, that thought is actually at the end of a whole chain of processes. Before that thought arises, there's a whole lot of things that happen in the mind that help us to make sense of what we've thought about or seen. For example, that we think we need is going to make me feel happy. Before we actually reach out for it, there's a process that takes place. And as we become more skilled in observing the mind, in making mindfulness a stronger quality in our mind, we become able to observe that process as it arises, as it leads to the thought of, I've got to have that. We will observe, once we become sufficiently mindful, that the first impulse arises because of an unpleasant physical feeling in the body, that sort of discomfort. Very, very subtle. Something isn't quite right. That unpleasant feeling we aren't sufficiently tuned into in ordinary experience, and we react almost automatically to make that unpleasant feeling go away. So, for example, as you sit here now, although you've been trying to sit comfortably, you'll notice that there is a feeling of discomfort that slowly arises the longer you sit. And without even thinking, without even being aware of what you're doing, you'll adjust your posture to be comfortable, not even consciously aware of that's what you're doing, to move away from that very slight feeling of discomfort. That discomfort arises in the body, but also in the mind. And from that discomfort, we move towards something, or we move away from something which we perceive as giving us that discomfort, or as being the solution to this discomfort. So we move away from the sitting posture that's uncomfortable, or we move towards the drink or the biscuit or whatever which we think is going to add something to this present moment that's lacking. Now, in this process, if we can stand back and be sufficiently mindful, we can become aware of how this process arises and how it gives rise in turn to the impulse to move towards or move away from. But we can only do this as we develop the mind in meditation. On the gross level, we can become aware of the ups and downs of life. On the gross level, we can become aware of the universality of these ups and downs. But if we really want to free ourselves from the craving that pushes us along, that sweeps us along, we have to be able to observe our reaction in the present moment in our own mind and body. And this is the practice that we have to undertake in our meditation. Once we understand the process, and once we are sufficiently familiar with it, we become able to bear with that feeling of discontent as it arises, simply as an unpleasant feeling. An unpleasant feeling that I can choose to respond to. I can choose to be equanimous to it. Just allow it to be. And from my meditation practice, if I observe the arising of these unpleasant feelings often enough, I will know that they're impermanent. They don't last forever. They pass away. And so we also develop the strength of mind in our meditation to bear with it long enough for it to pass away without being driven to react to it. We give ourselves a choice. We may choose to be equanimous, to know it, but not to act on it. Choose to act on it. But now we've got the power of choice within our control. Until then, we're just driven. And this is the other aspect of equanimity. We're not driven any longer by our habits. We're not driven by our preferences. We're not driven by our biases, by our prejudices. We don't always reach out, or don't always blame, or don't always react in a particular way because that's the way we've always done it. Now we have a choice over our reactions because we've been able to observe them, observe the process, and no longer identify with the desire as it's arising. We're no longer swept away by the river of craving as it arises in the present moment. And this is how we find freedom. And this is the equanimity that is part of the seven factors of enlightenment. This is the equanimity that develops from wisdom, from experientially knowing that craving can never be satisfied, being sufficiently in touch with our own experience to see how craving, no matter how much we feed it, arises again and again. Observing so that we know the process whereby desire arises, and being able to be sufficiently equanimous not to be driven to act to satisfy it. This is the path to freedom, and this is the other way of equanimity. Now, just to finish off, I'd like to mention another aspect of the understanding of going with the flow. Very often you'll hear people say that something's not working out for them. It's too difficult. There are obstacles in the path. And so maybe I'm not going with the flow well enough, or maybe it's not meant to happen. And very often this again gets confused in Buddhism with the idea that one shouldn't be attached. One shouldn't really strive. One shouldn't have preferences or things that you really want to achieve. And again, this is a misunderstanding of the Buddha's teaching. In the qualities of mind that the Bodhisattva had to develop in order to become the fully enlightened Buddha, three of these qualities are determination, energy, and patience. And so this points very clearly to the fact that there are things, there are times when we need to be determined and work very hard to achieve results that we want. Just because obstacles arise in our path, it's not necessarily an indication that we're not going with the flow and that it's not meant to be. Those obstacles may be just a further way of making us clarify how much we want what we're going for. So the understanding is not to see obstacles as necessarily meaning that this shouldn't happen. But the important aspect to consider in relation to this is our motivation and our intention. What are we going for? Is it something that is for my own well-being, for the well-being of others?
Is it something that is for my own harm? Is it for the harm of others? This is the criteria we use to decide whether or not we should go for it, not whether it's difficult or not. So we use our sila as a guideline. Is this within the five precepts? If it's within the five precepts, then there's an opportunity to say, yes, I go for it. Is this harmful or helpful? And if it's not harmful, if it's helpful, that's another green light to try for it. Sometimes we can be confused between our intention and our motivation. Sometimes it can look as though we have a good intention because what we're going for, the end result, seems to be a good thing. But our motivation can be not so useful. So we have to be clear about the difference between these two. Motivation is in terms of the root of the behaviour, whether it's based on greed, hatred and delusion, or whether it's based on non-greed, non-hatred and non-delusion. And the intention is what we hope to achieve by it. So because I think all of us are unenlightened at this stage, we can be sure that there's a little bit of delusion in whatever we're doing. But we can be more clear about whether we're acting out of greed or acting out of hatred, whether that is what's motivating us. Someone came to see me once when I was in Sri Lanka, and without telling me why they were coming, they had the purpose, the intention in their mind to write a book about spiritual life and spiritual seekers. And so when they came to spend some time with me, unknown to me, they were keeping notes of our conversations. And this was someone whom I'd known previously, so I was relating to them more as a friend. And so what I was saying to them was as I would speak to a friend. But unknown to me, they were taking notes and writing down what I was saying and also making judgments about how I'd changed and whether I was better than I was before and whether I was any brighter or any wiser and all this sort of thing. And a few months after they had left, I received a manuscript of what they had written. And it mightn't surprise you to know that I was quite upset by that, because I felt that this person hadn't been straightforward and honest and had breached our friendship. But in conversation with this person, she was very surprised at my reaction, because her intention was to produce a book which would inspire people, that would encourage them to be interested in pursuing the spiritual life. And she thought that having these this sort of close encounter with someone living this life would be inspiring for people. And so her intention on the surface was quite reasonable. But the way that she went about doing it was unreasonable. And it was fueled by a misunderstanding of hers of what was wholesome and what was unwholesome, what was skillful and what was unskillful. Her motivation was based on greed, hatred and delusion. She wanted to show the world what was the right way, what was the wrong way, and based on her own understanding. So her motivation was off. And although her intention superficially seemed to be a good one, the motivation meant that even the intention was tainted. And so very often when we're thinking about something that we have to put a lot of effort into, we have to be very honest with ourselves. You know, what am I hoping to get out of this? Am I hoping to be the person who can decide who's living this life well and who's not living this life well, and make judgments about people and compare and contrast, which is what was happening in this book? So what's really driving me to do this thing? And so if we examine our own motivation and we see that we're trying to do something which is beneficial for ourselves and others, based on non-hatred, non-greed, and as much as possible non-delusion, then we go for it. Not to think that obstacles mean that we shouldn't follow it, because we're not going with the flow. So I hope through my talk that I have shown you that in some ways the Buddha's teaching is about going with the flow. It's about going with the flow of wisdom, going with the flow of the truth, going with the flow of impermanence, going with the flow of unsatisfactoriness, going with the flow of non-self. Things change, ways we like and don't like. Things change in ways we can't control, because we're not actually in control of this mind and body or other people's minds and body. And there's suffering when we don't acknowledge that and accept it. And there's also suffering when we think that we're ever going to be able to come to the end of desire, that we're ever going to have that ultimate experience through the five senses, that we're ever going to reach the point of perfection. And so this is a way in which the Buddha's teaching isn't about going with the flow. It isn't about going with the flow of craving. The Buddha's teaching is about living a very deliberate life based on deep values of non-harming, of compassion and loving kindness. And so this is what we should always remember when we're making decisions about what we're going to do with our life, how we're going to spend our time. The Buddha's teachings relate not only to our inner world, but also to our world of relationships. And so if we ever have any doubts whether or not we should be going with the flow, we should always refer back to the specific teachings that the Buddha has given. And if we aren't able to satisfy ourselves through our own understanding, then we should always ask advice from those who have walked the path a little bit further and make use of their wisdom to help us in our life in all ways. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you on your own path and help all of you to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask? Well, if there are no questions...